I think that I believe that a marriage should be between a man and a woman. No offense to anybody out there.
It's the same answer that the President of the United States gave.
I believe that marriage is the union between a man and a woman.
I think that it should be between a man and a woman. Thank you.
It's the same answer that many people gave.
I am not somebody who promotes same-sex marriage.
She gave an honorable answer. She gave an answer from her heart. And I think for that, she has to be commended.
Southern Illinois truck drivers, love issues, etc.
So here's the argument that we often hear. And at first, it seems almost impenetrable. It's difficult to argue against something like this. Women struggled for equality all through the latter part of the 19th century, the 20th century, and still some in the 21st century. A longer struggle for equality when it comes to African Americans. In fact, it's not too long ago, it was illegal in some places in the United States for African Americans to marry outside their quote-unquote race. Interracial marriage was illegal. And today, the analogy is drawn that the same thing is happening all over again, but this time with homosexuals, with gays, lesbians, transgender, bisexual people who simply want to marry. It's the same struggle. And how do you answer that? We're going to talk about race, gender, and homosexual behavior for the first half hour of this hour of Issues, Etc. Greetings and welcome. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We are coming to you live this Friday afternoon. It is the 22nd of May. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE, and our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. We'll spend the first half hour talking about race, gender, and homosexual behavior. Then we'll review an Ascension Day sermon preached yesterday by Pastor George Borghardt. Our first guest, Dr. Robert Gagnon, is Associate Professor of New Testament at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, author of the book, The Bible and Homosexual Practice. Dr. Gagnon, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd, for having me.
Well, let's just simply take the argument head on, whether it's the struggle that women had for equality and full inclusion, or African Americans for equality and full inclusion and marriage rights. The same thing, the same struggle is now being undertaken by homosexuals who want to marry. How do you respond?
Well, sure, and then the same struggle will take place after we approve of homosexual practice for polyamorous persons with polysexual impulses that do not want to confine themselves to monogamy. They're oppressed, and we can keep going on down the line, of course, to the point of ultimate absurdity. The bottom line is that race and gender are not nearly as much like homosexual practice as is incest, I would argue, or multiple partner consensual unions, polyamory. When we look at the issue of race and gender, race is 100% heritable. Gender is 100% determined chromosomally. Both conditions are absolutely immutable. They're primarily non-behavioral conditions of life, and therefore they're intrinsically benign. Whereas when we look at the issue of homosexual orientation, it's entirely different. Whatever genetic influences there may be, and I believe there are some congenitally based influences for some homosexual development, it's certainly not a deterministic model. In other words, that you are born from birth as a person who is homosexual and nothing the society can do, nothing in terms of your upbringing could ever have any effect or impact on it. That simply does not turn out to be the case. And even the Kinsey Institute has acknowledged that roughly 75% of persons who claim to experience homosexual impulses will experience a shift of at least one on the Kinsey spectrum. Kinsey had a spectrum from 0 to 6, 0 being totally heterosexual, 6 being totally homosexual. And he argued just naturally, spontaneously, over the course of life, people will shift at least once, 75% of them, and most of those will shift at least twice over the course of life. So we're not talking about something deterministic like ethnicity or race or like sex or gender. And moreover, homosexuality is in the first instance an impulse to do something, to engage in behavior, and behavior that is clearly incompatible with their embodied existence as male or as female. And as such, it is therefore not intrinsically or inherently benign.
All right, I want to explore the term you've used there several times, because the argument is, of course, that not only morally, but in kind of a practical, the results of this behavior in one's life, that heterosexual behavior is indistinguishable from homosexual behavior. It has no consequences greater than that of regular heterosexual behavior. Is this, in fact, true?
Well, I think it's false on two levels. It's false first on the level simply from a nature argument, and it's false from the standpoint of looking at issues of scientifically measurable harm. If we look at the first issue from the standpoint of a nature argument, think about the difference between heterosexual attraction and homosexual attraction. You know, there are two obviously, I'm not saying anything astounding here to say that there are two primary sexes, male and female. This is certainly in point of Genesis 1:27, God made us male and female as natural complementary sexual pair. What a male brings to the sexual table, so to speak, in a sexual relationship is his maleness, his intrinsic maleness. What he does not bring is essential femaleness, and vice versa. The logic of a heterosexual union is that the two halves of the sexual spectrum, male and female, integrate into a complete sexual whole. By the same token, the logic of a homosexual union is that two half-males merge into a full male. Two half-females merge into a full female, because the nature of the sexual bond is to integrate in complementary fashion with what one is not. That's the reason why we limit the sexual union to two persons at any one time. It's why Jesus himself rejected more than two partners in a sexual union, whether serially or concurrently, because God made us male and female, a natural sexual pair. So what a person who has homosexual desire desires is what that individual already possesses. A male with homosexual desires desires to merge and is sexually aroused by what he already is. That is intrinsic maleness. And the same thing with a lesbian relationship. Scripture views that as inherently self-dishonoring, because the implication of it is that you desire to complete yourself, but in fact you are already complete in your maleness. It's sexually what you lack as a male is not maleness, but femaleness, and vice versa. So to engage in sexual union with somebody of the same sex is in effect to say that I'm not fully male, and to dishonor the, or female if one is a woman, and to dishonor the sexuality that God has stamped in one's being as not being completely whole as male or as female. As far as disproportionately high rates of harm, it's quite clear that homosexual practice exhibits measurable rate of high harm, and they do so in ways that are different between homosexual males and homosexual females. So it's not just an issue of homophobia. It's an issue of attempting to merge with somebody who's already too much of a same. And so the extremes of a given sex, take two males, of maleness, is exponentially increased, and the gaps in the sexual self are not filled. So rather than moderating the extremes of maleness or moderating the extremes of femaleness by sexually uniting with somebody who is sexually other than oneself, the extremes are actually exacerbated. And that's why we get among male homosexual unions much higher incidences of sexually transmitted disease and numbers of sex partners over the course of life. And it's why we get in female homosexual unions lower longevity of the relationship, even relative to male homosexual unions on average, and higher incidences of mental health issues, because, again, all these correspond to extremes, facets of maleness and femaleness, not moderated by merging with a sexual other.
Let's talk a bit about as you have said, the proper analogy is not between race and gender, but between incest and consensual incest and consensual polyamory, or we might say kind of more popularly polygamy, but it's certainly not limited to one man with several wives. Why is that? Where are the similarities between homosexual behavior and consensual incest and polyamory?
Well, in the case of incestuous behavior, when we think about what is incest, you know, there's a nice little definition given in Leviticus 18:6. It's often obscured in translation, but the Hebrew is quite clear. You shall not have intercourse with the flesh of your own flesh. That is, you shall not attempt to merge sexually with somebody who's too much of a close kin and who therefore on the level of kinship is too much like oneself. And we see the symptom of this root problem when the attempt is made to procreate and you have much higher incidences of harm in birth defects arising from an incestuous union. But that's the symptom of the root problem. There's too much identity between the persons on the level of kinship. There has to be a certain degree of otherness within the context of sameness. The sameness, of course, is they're both humans, but the otherness comes from the standpoint of one being close kin with each other. Well, that's the same problem with homosexual practice, but here on the level of sex or gender rather than the level of kinship.
Well, let's take a break right here because I wanted you to be able to finish that thought, the connection between consensual incest and homosexual behavior, a far better analogy than race or gender when comparing it to homosexual behavior. And then I guess there must be a different principle at work when it comes to polyamory, but we'll find out what that is on the other side of this break. We're talking about race, gender, and homosexual behavior this Friday afternoon, May the 22nd, here on Issues Etc. Our call-in number 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Or talk back at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about race, gender, and homosexual behavior. Dr. Robert Gagnon is our guest. Dr. Gagnon, you were in the middle of a point when we went to that break. You were talking about when it comes to incest and homosexual behavior, the similarity has to do with, well, the similarity between the two partners. Pick up where you left off, if you would.
Yes, it's excessive, what one could call formal or embodied or structural similarity between the participants. And that excessive similarity is what creates the problems in procreation, but it also extends beyond the issue of procreation to the problem of being aroused or attracted by essentially what one already is, whether on the level of kinship in the case of incest or whether it's in the case of gender or sex as regards homosexual practice. Scripture views that as a form of sexual narcissism or a form of sexual self-deception. Narcissism in the sense that one is aroused or attracted by one's own essence as kin, or in the case of homosexual practice, one's own sex that one shares with one's sexual partner, or a sexual self-deception in the sense of not recognizing the wholeness that one has in the case of homosexual practice as a male, if male, or as a female, if female. What I'd ask people to think about here in evaluating the comparison is, what do they find wrong about incest? And if they just tell you, well, because incest can lead to birth defects if they procreate, then all one has to say is, well, then how would you feel about an incestuous relationship where two people were of the same sex and no possibility of procreation existed? Or if one or the other partner in another sex incestuous relationship was past the point or for any other reason not fertile, would you then approve of the incestuous relationship? I doubt that anyone seriously would, because they would recognize that the root problem is that over-identity in terms of kinship. But that's, by analogy, the same point that's made about homosexual practice.
What is the what's the comparison then? If that's incest, what about consensual polyamory with homosexual behavior?
Well, it's interesting that incest is related to homosexual practice analogically. That is, the two sexes prerequisite, male and female, establishes the principle of a degree of complementary otherness among the sexual participants. And it's that degree of complementary otherness that leaves Scripture to become, in the Old Testament, increasingly consistent in its opposition to all incest. However, in the case of polyamory, the relationship is a little bit different to homosexual practice. There, homosexual practice is the inverse of that, the two sexes prerequisite, a male and female prerequisite. is the foundation on which all polyamory, multiple partner sexual bonds, are prohibited by Jesus. So when Jesus wants to argue the question about how many sexual partners you're entitled to in the course of life, whether serially in the case of serial divorce and remarriage, ad infinitum, or in the case of concurrent polygamy, that is, having for men more than one wife, what he appeals to is the text in Genesis 1:27, male and female he made them, in Genesis 2:24. For this reason, a man may become joined to a woman, and the two become one flesh. In other words, it's the two-ness of the sexes that becomes the foundation for limiting the number of partners in a sexual union to two. It's the fact that male and female create an inherent duality, an inherent two-ness in the sexual bond that limits the number of persons in a sexual union to two. You've brought together the only two persons, the only two sexes, I should say, in the sexual spectrum, male and female. So therefore, a third party is neither necessary nor desirable. That's Jesus' argumentation. We know it's Jesus' argumentation because the very same text, Genesis 1:27, is cited by an early Jewish community called the Qumran community as an argument for rejecting polygamy in Israel. They said men should not be having multiple wives because God made us male and female. Two persons, two different sexes that pair together that preclude the notion of a third party in the sexual bond. And then they added another text that's similar. The only other set of texts in the Old Testament that used the phrase male and female, zaka une keva, along with the text in Genesis 1:27 and its parallel in Genesis 5:1, and that's the text in the Noah's Ark narrative, which talks about they went in the ark two by two, zaka une keva, male and female. And they say, aha, you see that connection between male and female in two-ness? That's why there ought not to be any more polygamy in ancient Israel. God cut men a break in sexual relationships that he never cut women. Women were always bound by a monogamy principle. There was no such thing as a woman having multiple husbands. And now it's time to be consistent here across the board and not cut men an extra break. And men, too, now are only bound, only allowed, entitled one other sexual partner of the other sex lifetime. So that's Jesus' reasoning. So it's the two-ness of the sexes that is the foundation and the predicate for limiting the number of persons in a sexual union to two.
In a related way, Dr. Gagnon, there's a new survey by Public Religion Research that shows that on a range of policy issues, mainline Protestant clergy, and here we're talking about United Methodist Church, Presbyterian Church USA, various other church bodies, are generally more supportive of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered rights than the general population, mostly in line with mainline Protestants overall. Two-thirds of mainline clergy support hate crimes legislation. Let's see. Same-sex marriage is only major lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered public policy issue that does not enjoy a majority support from mainline clergy. On the issue, one-third support same-sex marriage. A majority do support civil unions there. What are your thoughts on this as a member of the Presbyterian Church USA, one of those mainline denominations?
Well, it's not entirely surprising to me because mainline denominations tend to be infected and affected by the broader cultural view because many people in mainline denominations don't like the idea of suffering for what they believe, and they would like to be approved by society and receive society support. That's often why we're in mainline denominations. We like the respectability that comes with that, but the danger of that is that then we would dilute the gospel and not call people to the kinds of lives that God is calling us to and Jesus Christ is calling us to so that we can avoid experiencing abuse at the hands of the world ourselves. Well, unfortunately, that's not really a good mode to operate with. My other comment about it is it's kind of absurd for people to say that they support civil unions, but they don't support gay marriage because to support the former necessarily leads to the latter. It's just a matter of time. That's why the Massachusetts Supreme Court essentially said, look, what's the point of civil unions? By hate crime legislation, by sexual employment non-discrimination, sexual orientation under so-called non-discrimination legislation, and other kinds of sexual orientation laws, you've already established these should be specially protected categories of life. So it's sheer bigotry now for you to refuse marriage to them. That's absolutely true as logic goes. not to be supporting elevating sexual orientation, homosexual orientation, and transgenderism to specially protected categories on the level of race and gender, because again, they're much more like the issues of incest and polyamorous behavior and sexual orientation than they are like race or gender.
How would you respond to someone who says that kind of hate crimes legislation and the logic behind it won't ultimately affect pastors in their practice?
Well, they're living in a fairy tale world. It certainly will. I mean, the biggest damage the hate crime legislation does is it establishes homosexual orientation and transsexualism as specially protected classes. And it also establishes them as benign and non-harmful and in no way immoral, in the same way that race and gender are benign conditions. So that automatically establishes in law that a person who opposes homosexual practice or transsexualism is the moral equivalent and legal equivalent of a racist or misogynist. That is the inevitable byproduct of so-called hate crime legislation. Hate crime legislation will do nothing to stop so-called hate. What it does instead is define any opposition to homosexual practice as hate, and any opposition to transsexualism as hate. And it's just the stepping stone. Once that principle is established, all the rest of the dominoes will fall, leading to the next thing in so-called employment non-discrimination legislation, which turns out to be employment discrimination legislation if you don't fully approve of homosexual behavior, and from there, civil unions, and from there, gay marriage. All those are inevitable once the category of sexual orientation and transgenderism is ensconced in federal law.
Folks, you can purchase The Bible and Homosexual Practice on the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Robert Gagnon is Associate Professor of New Testament at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary and author of the book, The Bible and Homosexual Practice. Dr. Gagnon, thank you again for being our guest.
Thanks for having me on, Todd.
Well, coming up on the 30th of June, we're going to be celebrating the one-year return of Issues Etc. to the air. 1 year ago, on June 30th, we were back on the air, and we want to celebrate it with you, our listeners, by inviting you out to LPR Studios here in Collinsville, Illinois, on Tuesday, June the 30th, starting at 4 o'clock. You can come out and watch the show being done live, and then we'll join you for some food outside, some barbecue. Tuesday, June the 30th, starting at 4 o'clock. We need to know that you're coming and how many are coming, so you need to RSVP. You do that by emailing Craig at issuesetc.org, Craig at issuesetc.org. It's the Issues Etc. anniversary event beginning 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Tuesday, June the 30th at LPR Studios here in Collinsville, Illinois, Craig at issuesetc.org. When we come back, coming off of the Ascension Day celebration yesterday, we'll review an Ascension Day sermon preached by Pastor George Borghardt of St. Mark Lutheran Church in Conroe, Texas, a sermon review for the last half hour of this Friday's Issues Etc.